Welcome to the Jewish Lives Podcast, a monthly show by Jewish Lives, the prize-winning biography series published by Yale University Press and the Leon D. Black Foundation. I'm your host, Alessandra Wallner. Today, we're looking at celebrated Dada and Surrealist artist Man Ray. In the second part of the show, I'll sit down with Arthur Lubau, author of the Jewish Lives biography, Man Ray, the Artist and His Shadows. If you like what you hear, rate us on Apple Podcasts and leave a friendly review. Thank you in advance. You can learn more about our books at jewishlives.org. Join us as we explore the Jewish experience together. In December 1916, the artist Man Ray exhibited a piece at the Daniel Gallery in New York that he titled Self-Portrait. This was not, however, a self-portrait in any conventional sense of the word. At the top of a rectangular wooden panel, Man Ray had affixed two handbells. He put a doorbell at the bottom, which he framed with two F-holes like those on a violin. In the middle of the frame, he placed a bloody-looking handprint, his own. Visitors pressed the button, expecting it to ring, but the doorbell stayed silent. Not because of any mechanical error on the artist's part. The silence was exactly his intent. It was cerebral, conceptual, mysterious, and highly symbolic. But of what? Man Ray's self-portrait is a perfect example of this artist's approach. Once Man Ray declared, "To be successful, art must be unsellable." And according to the critics and his gallerist, self-portrait was certainly that. Man Ray was a tireless experimenter who left many elements of his work to chance and spontaneity. He was also a master of making the native foreign and changing the mundane into something alien. His capacity to transform is on display in his piece, The Gift, which Man Ray created by gluing a line of 14 tacks to the bottom of a clothing iron, transforming an everyday domestic device into an object of terror. His particular brand of creativity was embraced by members of the absurdist Dada movement, and his impulse towards defamiliarization was a perfect match for the movement that arrived on Dada's heels, Surrealism, which sought to unmask the uncanny lurking just beneath the surface of all things. Man Ray was born Emanuel Radnitsky in Philadelphia in 1890. The son of Russian Jewish immigrants, his parents shortened and anglicized their last name to Ray. Later, Manny trimmed back his name even further, shortening Emanuel to the evocative and austere Man. Man Ray spoke rarely or not at all of his Jewish heritage, but the son of a professional tailor and a home seamstress, many of Man Ray's pieces contain hints at his immigrant origins. Like one of his most famous works, The Enigma of Isidore Ducasse. It's a sewing machine, shrouded in rough fabric, bound by twine. Over the course of his life, Man Ray had many lovers and muses. His art practice was similarly diverse. He worked across many mediums: paint, collage, assemblage, sculpture, filmmaking, and photography. Of all of these, he's most famous for his photos, which run the gamut from avant-garde experiments to fashion shoots appearing in Vogue, Vanity Fair, and Harper's Bazaar, to formal portraiture of the era's artistic luminaries. Pablo Picasso, James Joyce, Gertrude Stein, Jean Cocteau, Salvador Dali, Peggy Guggenheim, and Antonin Artaud all posed for Man Ray. He was a unique creator in that he was an obsessive and exacting technician who also possessed an artist's explosive creativity. This rare combination of qualities prompted Man Ray to innovate as a photographer. In his body of work, you'll find rayograms, images created directly on photographic paper without the use of a camera, and solarizations, which produce an electric corona of light around the image's subject. But it was Man Ray's visionary and innovative notion to photograph his surrealist assemblages, like his fabric-wrapped sewing machine, and present the images not as documentation, but as art itself, that helped elevate photography to an art form all its own. Today, Man Ray's significance is widely recognized and celebrated. You can see his photographs, paintings, and sculptures in museums all over the world: the Getty in Los Angeles, the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, the Musée d'Orsay in Paris, and New York's Museum of Modern Art. Man Ray died in 1976 in Paris at the age of 86. He's buried in the Montparnasse Cemetery, under an epitaph that distills his philosophy of art and his outlook on life to four simple yet striking words: unconcerned, but not indifferent. Discover a biography of the elusive but celebrated Dada and surrealist artist and photographer in a book that connects his Jewish background to his life and art. It's Man Ray, The Artist and His Shadows by Arthur Lubau. Save 25% plus get free shipping. For a limited time only, use code MANRAY, that's one word, at checkout. Only at jewishlives.org. Hi, Arthur Lubau, and welcome to the Jewish Lives podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Man Ray created in many different mediums, but he wanted to be known for his painting rather than his photography. And I wanted to start by asking you why that was.
Back when Man Ray was really alive, but certainly when he was at the height of his career, photography was not viewed as an art equal to the other arts. I mean, it was barely regarded as an art at all. So it was natural for Man Ray not to want to be considered a photographer and want to be viewed as a painter, which was the noblest of the arts, really, even more perhaps than sculpture. But those were the two main arts, and photography was a kind of stepsister.
And whether he liked it or not, what ended up happening is that Man Ray is most remembered for his photography. And as a fun aside, one of his famous portraits is of another Jewish Lives subject, Peggy Guggenheim, and that's on display at the Guggenheim Collection in Venice. So what is it about his photography that became so memorable, his portraits and his art pieces more than his paintings?
His photography was creative and original in a way that his painting was not. It's as simple as that. Remember, he was in Paris in the 1920s and 1930s. He was up against the two greatest painters of the 20th century, Picasso and Matisse. So his paintings, by comparison, can only seem a little bit derivative and a little bit mannered. They're not quite at that level. Whereas his photography, nobody else was doing it in Paris at that level. And he was endlessly inventive. I mean, one of the ironies of Man Ray is that he claimed to be interested only in concepts and not in technique, but actually he was brilliant in painting as well as in photography, but especially in photography. So he made pictures that were startling. He began as a Dadaist and then advanced when the movement advanced to being a surrealist, but he could look at things in novel ways. There's a photograph, which I love, of a woman smoking a cigarette. The hair of the woman is at the bottom of the picture, and the cigarette is standing up like a chimney at the top of the picture. Her hair looks to me like a field of wheat. So you're suddenly seeing something that you would have seen, especially in Paris in the 20s, countless times, a woman smoking a cigarette, but you're seeing it in a completely different way. He had an enormous technical proficiency, again, which he didn't boast about and even deprecated as being important. But that lent itself somehow more to photography, which is, you know, depends on mechanics, even more, I mean, much more obviously than painting. And he was good at it. So much to his chagrin, he became known as a photographer.
You said something really interesting in the last answer, which is that in the book you write, Man Ray wanted his art to be the product of his mind, not his hand, meaning that he thought execution was secondary and the conceptual always came first. And so how did this orientation reveal itself in his work?
It's an interesting question because, in fact, he said this when he developed a technique that he called the aerograph, in which he would basically spray paint without using a brush on the canvas. Now, these pictures were not understood in New York, although they were later in Paris. But the point is that they're beautiful. So he acted as though this was merely coming directly out of his mind onto the canvas, as if the spraying of the paint were a cerebral activity. In fact, he had to develop this extremely carefully. So yes, he said that he cared about the idea and not the execution. And he said that a lot about photography. He disparaged people who would ask what kind of lens he used. But in fact, in order to convey a concept clearly and powerfully, you need to have some technique. And he did.
Very evocatively, Man Ray once wrote in a letter, "New York is sweet but cold. Paris is bitter but warm." Why did he prefer Paris to the city where he was raised?
In New York, he felt really misunderstood. The newspapers did acknowledge him, but they made fun of him. In Paris, even though he couldn't speak the language when he went over there, everybody he met looked up to him. He was a bit older than most of them, except for Duchamp. And he had all of these credentials that they respected. Also, they respected America because they thought that it was the place of the future. But I think the main thing is that when he got to Paris, he was accepted in this group of Dadaists that were mainly writers. And writers and artists mingled together. In New York, they didn't do that. And he felt that this commingling was what he wanted. It was more astringent. I think that's what he meant by bitter in Paris than in New York. But I think he wanted to get away from whatever sentimentality existed in New York as well.
And you just mentioned perhaps the most important relationship in Man Ray's life, which was with the artist Marcel Duchamp. Tell us about their friendship.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most touching and really moving friendships in art history. They met in Richfield, New Jersey, where Man Ray was living at that time, just across the Hudson River from New York City. And Duchamp did not speak English. Man Ray did not speak French. But they immediately hit it off. They shared the same sense of humor. They shared the belief that the concept was more important than the execution. They supported each other and they enjoyed each other without any rivalry. And that is, I think, really rare.
On another important relationship, you write about Man Ray's romantic involvement with the photographer Lee Miller. And you say that was the most creatively fruitful, but also emotionally devastating relationship of his life. What characterized their dynamic?
I think the way they met predicts all that would follow. Lee Miller came to Paris determined to study with Man Ray and to learn photography. She had decided that she wanted to be a photographer. She met him at a bar that he frequented. She introduced herself. She said, "I'm Lee Miller and I'm your next student." And he said, I don't have students. And besides, I'm about to leave for Beirut. And she said, so am I. And that began this romance and this professional collaboration. She was 17 years younger. She was completely independent. She was extremely beautiful and very talented. And I think she was the woman of his dreams, but she didn't want to tie herself to one man. They did work together. Lee Miller later said that many pictures she didn't know if Man Ray or she had pressed the shutter release. So they were very close, but she was seeing other men while she was involved with Man Ray. And eventually she decided that she was going to leave him, and he was devastated by her departure.
Now, Man Ray shrewdly observed that to create is divine, to reproduce is human. And towards the end of his life, a third party began reproducing and selling his most famous works. For most artists, this would be seen as selling out. But for Man Ray, it was kind of an oddly fitting outcome. And I'm wondering if you agree with that.
I think yes, but like with many things about Man Ray, it's complicated. He had done these ready-mades, is the name that is associated with them, because Duchamp, it's something that Duchamp had introduced. The notion is that you could just take something that you found in a hardware store, give it a name, and it becomes an art object. It's one of the most influential things to have occurred in 20th century art, and it really changed the notion of authorship. Man Ray, though, did something a bit different. He would combine a couple of things that didn't seem to go together. So he would put a hammer in a sleeve because the word in French, manche, is the same depending on whether you're using a masculine or feminine pronoun. And that was a typical Man Ray assisted ready-made. But the most important thing about Man Ray's use of ready-mades is that he didn't keep them. He photographed them. And the photograph became the art object, really. He would then destroy what he had photographed. So there was something a little bit perverse in going back and recreating these objects that had been destroyed and making them, additioning them as things that could be sold. And that is a little bit troubling to me because it did seem somehow to undercut the originality of his original notion.
Where do you see Man Ray's continued influence in modern art today, or do you?
Yeah, I think he is. I mean, I think he's influential as a photographer. I know that Robert Mapplethorpe, it was his favorite photographer, which is odd, but he liked him because he thought that Man Ray was so inventive. But even more importantly, I think he was very early on to the idea that an artist doesn't have to restrict himself to one medium. And he needn't be even just a painter and sculptor. He could also be a photographer. He could also be a filmmaker. There's something really forward-looking about his, I was going to say willingness, but really eagerness to pursue all different kinds of practices and explore all different media in order to express his ideas.
And if you could speak to Man Ray, is there anything you'd ask him or say to him?
I'm curious to know what he would have thought about Paris, but about one particular thing. I know that he would say, or I'm pretty positive that he would say, that his career could never have developed the way it did had he not gone to Paris. But what I wonder is, had he not been forced to leave Paris in 1940 because of the onset of the war and the fall of Paris to the Germans, and go back to America and live in Los Angeles, and then eventually return to Paris. But that interruption, I think, cut off his career prematurely. This would be a terrible question to ask, so I probably wouldn't be able to do it. But I wonder if he'd ever suspected that his expulsion from Paris was fatal to his career.
Well, thank you, Arthur Lubau, for talking with us about your new book, Man Ray, The Artist and His Shadows.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This episode, we have a special message for our listeners. We're pleased to announce the first annual Jewish Lives Unessay Contest, designed to engage U.S. high school students with Jewish history while unleashing their creativity. To engage all students, we've chosen the format of an unessay. An un-essay can take any creative form. A traditional written essay, a video, visual art, a poem, or even a podcast. The 2021-2022 un-essay question is, if you could spend a day with one figure from Jewish history, who would it be and what would you do? Students are eligible to win up to $1,000 in prizes. Finalist submissions will be reviewed by the editors of the Jewish Lives series. We hope you'll share this message with the high schoolers in your life. Submission deadline is December 17th, 2021. To view contest rules and to complete the student registration, please visit jewishlives.org/unessay. Thank you and good luck. The Jewish Lives podcast is made possible by the Leon D. Black Foundation. Special thanks to our partners at Yale University Press, Jewish Lives editorial director Eileen Smith, series editors Anita Shapira and Stephen J. Zipperstein, managing director Rebecca Keyes, and to Linda Brennan and Ruby Elliott Zuckerman. The Jewish Lives podcast is hosted and produced by me, Alessandra Wallner. Our music is composed by Barry J. Cohen. Groucho Marx once said, "Outside of a dog, a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read." Watch for forthcoming Jewish Lives titles, including Judah Benjamin and Abraham Joshua Heschel.